Hello, 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 and welcome to another edition of Back to the Basics. I am your host, Michael Dagger, and today's show, I'm just going to recap a little bit of some of the big sporting news that's happened in the past couple days, since probably the past weeks, including the World Cup finals, and then some other quick basketball notes and stuff like that. But then I'm going to be joined by Noah Heemer once again, and we have another football-based podcast, another football-based episode that I ran in my other podcast that's going to be used here, and that is all about the devaluation of the running back position, or we just have like an open discussion of how we view it after Le'Veon Bell and the Pittsburgh Steelers couldn't come to a contract extension, so he's playing on the franchise tag, and he feels he deserves more money. So we get into a little bit of how we would pay Le'Veon and this, what the Steelers should do, then a little wide-ranging discussion of the future of the running back position, and then with college football media days approaching and the Big 12 changing their slogan to the toughest road to the playoff, it prompted this discussion of between him and I about what is the toughest conference and what is the toughest division in a conference in all of college football. And then we concluded with building off of Larry Fedora's, the coach of North Carolina's, comments about the football, the game of football being under attack. We stay away from the political side of it, which is kind of just, I'm not going to say outrageous, but it's just, we'll get to that. You'll hear about that later in the show, but we talk about, you know, we played football growing up. So we talked about, you know, what we think the future of football is at, and what are some ways, not necessarily what we would change, but some tendencies that we've noticed that we think that could make the game safer and allow it to keep progressing and expanding in the future. But we'll get to Noah later. I just have a quick 25 minutes just talking some stuff. So we'll start with the World Cup, and I'm fine to admit that I was wrong, and France took down Croatia in a fitting end to the World Cup 4-2 about a week ago, last Sunday. And of course there's controversy. There always has to be controversy in a soccer match. And the first came with France scored, if you didn't watch the game, I'll do a quick 30-second recap. France scores on a free kick, own goal, which the free kick was awarded with a dive. Antoine Griezmann wasn't fouled. Anyways, the VR expansion doesn't work, I guess, like that. Sometimes it, like, you're allowed to review stuff, but you're not allowed to review simple penalties like that. And that costs Croatia one goal. And then Croatia gets it equalized, and right on the stroke of halftime, a handball, unintentional handball is called, but nevertheless, it was a handball. France converts it. A lot of controversy with there. 2-1 into halftime. Croatia was the dominating team in terms of possession and chances and touches in the opponent's half and third, in the final third, but they couldn't get anything. They couldn't just get the final. The quality at the end was not there. And then Paul Pogba and Kylian Mbappe, two of the young stars of this World Cup, got two great counterattack goals. Croatia gets a wonder goal, but like a error by the goalkeeper for France, Hugo Lloris, who makes a bad mistake, 4-2. And then it just slowly, France just grinds out the win. And that's kind of like a microcosm of the whole World Cup into one game, because most of the goals were scored on set pieces. There was 13 own goals, which shattered the record for the most own goals in a tournament. There was a controversial VAR penalty, and then the team that got less shots, less possession, ended up winning. So it was the perfect end to the World Cup, and it caps off a great World Cup. You know, people worry that stateside here, that there wasn't going to be a lot of interest, because without the USA, without it, personally speaking, Italy wasn't in it, which was probably more disappointing than USA, because one of my fondest memories is Italy winning the World Cup in terms of soccer and stuff like that. So it still was great. You know, it just stinks that we have to wait another 4 years, but I guess that's what makes the World Cup so brilliant, is that it comes every 4 years. It captivates the world's attention for that short time, for that month, and then it just goes right in the way. But the good thing is, I don't know if anyone's a big club fan, but club season, Premier League, begins in just 20 days. So August 10th picks right back up. I'm looking forward to that. I'll try to do a little preview depending on how much soccer interest there is. But I love the sport. I've mentioned that the past couple of times I've been on the show. So, I mean, I don't really want to dive too much in the World Cup. It's been a week now. It's kind of relaxed. And we've had the big Ronaldo transfer to Juventus. Personally speaking, Liverpool added the most expensive goalkeeper in the world from Brazil, Alisson Becker. So there's just a little things right now. There's just going to be a lot of transfer speculation, a lot of money being thrown around the big clubs and stuff like that over the next couple weeks until the season starts. And then we have 10 more months of soccer. But the thing is about the next World Cup is that it's going to be in Qatar. I hope I'm saying that right. I don't think it's Qatar. I think it's pretty sure it's Qatar. And it's not, and it, because of the climate during the summer in that country, which is okay in the Middle East, it's the World Cup is taking place November to December in 2022. And that's weird. It's going to cause some, it's going to cause some weird scheduling issues for the teams in the tournament. I mean, in like in the, with their clubs and stuff, but I'm sure we'll adapt and stuff like that because it's the World Cup. It's the most important sporting event in the sport, most important event in that sport, the most watched sporting event in the world. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, I'm still going to watch it regardless of what time it is, what time of the year it is and stuff like that. So we'll leave it at that. And we're going to transition to, we have about 19 minutes. Just want to touch on two of the big NBA stories that happened. One's big, one necessarily isn't really that big. And because the NBA, it's now like a 12-month league, but it's, I think it's finally going to die down. I think August will be a nice, August, September, there'll be a nice break in terms of what, in terms of news slowing down. But we had one of the best players in the NBA, Kawhi Leonard, got traded to the Toronto Raptors on Wednesday, I believe. Tuesday or Wednesday, for a star, an all-star, a gold medal winning champion, a gold medal winner for the USA in DeMar DeRozan. And it's caught a lot of, it didn't really surprise a lot of people because it's been building steam that the Raptors were the team to make this move with the 76ers and the Lakers and the Celtics not really willing to give up their assets for a potential one-year rental because it's heavily noted that he wants to go to, that Kawhi wants to sign in LA, whether it's the Lakers or the Clippers. So the Raptors made the move. They, just like last year with Paul George being traded to Oklahoma City Thunder when everything was pointing towards him going to the Lakers, they bet on their culture. They bet on themselves. They bet on what they've built with Sam Presti as a GM and Russell Westbrook being a team leader. And they won that bet. Paul George stayed with Oklahoma City, didn't even take meetings in other teams. And the Raptors are betting on the same thing because Masai Ujiri, the general manager of the Raptors, one of the best general managers in basketball, he traded, I'm not going to get into the logistics of DeMar DeRozan being the best player in Raptors history, but he's certainly the most loyal. You know, he did that infamous tweet in 2010 where he said, "We're going to fix this. I'm here." Last year, signed a max, I don't know if it's a max, right around the max contract for a player with his stipulations and stuff. He didn't even take meetings with other teams. He loves Toronto. This is a kid from Compton, California. Fell in love with the city, wanted to be the person that got them over the hump, and he was shipped out for a potential one-year rental in Kawhi Leonard. And that has to sting DeMar. I mean, I don't know how he's feeling. I'm not a professional athlete. I don't know. I understand why it hurts, but the team that they had just couldn't get over the hump in the playoffs. They ran into LeBron every year. And I know LeBron's in the West, but they just felt like they needed not a culture change, but a quick reset. And by acquiring Kawhi Leonard, they have significantly, and the guy not to be let out, Danny Green, who has the record for most 3-pointers in the NBA Finals before, one of the best wing defenders, a great spot up shooter, and stuff like that. So the Raptors really, if Kawhi plays, they improve their team. And in my opinion, they're the best team in the East. Better than the Raptors. I mean, better than the Celtics. Better than the Sixers. And you look at their roster. They have wings across the board. Long, lengthy wings. Their first-year coach, Nick Nurse, has a lot to deal with now. Because Kawhi, there's reports that Kawhi may not even report. But if he does, and it's a big if, I can't see him sitting out a second consecutive season. I feel like that would really rub people the wrong way, even though a lot of this has rubbed people the wrong way to begin with. Him pretty much finding discourse with one of the most steady organizations, probably the steadiest organization in basketball over the past 20 years with the Spurs. And he found his way out, and they sent him to Toronto. I'll start with the team dynamics. So, if people not familiar with them, with the Raptors, they have Kyle Lowry, All-Star Gold Medal. He was best friends with DeMar DeRozan. I recommend going online and looking up their YouTube. YouTube their friendship, and there's just a bunch of funny hits of them two making fun of each other in interviews and just seemingly love hanging out and being best friends. So they have an All-Star point guard now. Yeah, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, OG Anunoby, who's a rookie, who's a second-year player, 6'8", 6'9", can defend, has a 7-foot-plus wingspan, can defend 1 through 5. Same thing with Kawhi, same thing with Danny Green. And then you can throw out Pascal Siakam, who's maybe not be known to the casual fan, but he's another 6'8", 6'9" guy who can defend on the perimeter. He guarded LeBron at stretches. He guarded John Wall in the playoffs. He's one of the quickest point guards, and he was on him. So there's just a lot of lineup options. Even they have still have Serge Ibaka, who can do some things. Jonas Valanciunas, CJ Miles is a sharp shooter off the bench. And Darion Wright, another 6'6" point guard. Fred VanVleet, one of the smartest point guards in basketball. There's just... Look, on paper, and playoffs are all about matchups, and they have arguably better... They are equipped to handle the Celtics in their wings and Kyrie. They're equipped to handle the 76ers when they want to go big, and they get the Valanciunas and Ibaka. They can do a lot of things with their lineup. They can play fast, small, big, slow, anything you want if Kawhi plays. And that's a big if. I'm pretty sure he'll play. So looking at from that perspective, I really like this move. From the Raptors' perspective. And the thing about it is, Kyle Lowry and Serge Ibaka, they're on big deals, but they're on short contracts. They have 2 years left. And then you look at DeMar DeRozan, he had 4 years left on a max, at a premium, at a cost. One is not going to be able to do a lot of flexibility with their cap. So if this 1 year rental doesn't work, Danny Green's on an expiring contract as well, same as Kawhi. I'm sure they can find suitors for Kyle Lowry for an expiring deal, Serge Ibaka on an expiring deal. I'm sure they can find ways to maneuver that and maybe even get some nice assets back in the return. And even that's if they don't get Kawhi, and that's if this experiment fails. But say Kawhi, who people are reporting has no intention to re-signing in Toronto if he plays, he hates the cold weather. Toronto isn't the coldest city in Canada. I know everyone thinks that. I lived in Winnipeg, which is the coldest city in Canada, with over 600,000 people in the world, that is, too. But Toronto is bearable with the cold, but he hates the cold. Apparently, when they had the All-Star Weekend was in Toronto in 2016, I want to say. Yeah, 2016, and he apparently didn't even leave his room. He apparently had a miserable time. He would just show up for the game and show face a little bit, then leave. So it's a touchy situation. I don't see him. It's everything that we know about Kawhi Leonard says you wouldn't sign here. But Canada loves their Raptors. It's one of the biggest markets in the NBA. It's one of the best cities in the NBA in terms of cuisine, culture. They have some of the best fans in the sport. And if you can't tell, they are now making aggressive moves to contend right away and build the team around Kawhi in the modern game. And it's just, I would put nothing besides their GM in their front office. Masai Ujiri. I hope I'm not botching his name. I mentioned him earlier. He's one of the top salesmen in the NBA in terms of saying, hey, this is the picture I'm painting. If you want in, we can literally contend for titles. LeBron's gone. The Celtics still have young pieces. You know, Kawhi and Kyrie is coming off an injury. Gordon Hayward's coming off an injury. Al Horford's getting up there in age. 76ers are still young. They have star players and stuff, but they still seem to be a year or two away from fully competing. The Bucks don't really have enough around Giannis, the Greek freak, yet. The Pacers, yeah, they're sturdy and they're a fighter and they have talent, but this Raptors team should be able to handle them. The Wizards are a question mark every year. They seem to fluctuate in terms of being winning a series or two and then losing in the first round and barely making the playoffs. And you look at that, there's no reason why this team, there's no reason why the Raptors can make the finals. And if you have a road to the finals every year, playing in the East, playing in a culture like the Raptors, playing in a city like Toronto, why wouldn't you just suck it up for, you know, yeah, it's going to be cold for 4 months while you're there, but, you know, you can spend 8 months in beautiful Toronto and then the rest, you can spend a couple months in beautiful Toronto and then the rest you're going to be in LA anyway. So I feel like that's what the front office and the ownership is going to sell Kawhi on and be like, hey, we're building something here. We can offer you the Supermax, 5 years, $192 million. Any other team can offer you $4 million, $140 million. And I know that doesn't sound like a big deal, like, oh, you know, just what's a couple hundred million to a player? What's 50 million to a player already making nine figures anyway? But, you know, people think about that. And we don't know how much Kawhi's values. He doesn't seem to value money over everything, but he's one of the hardest superstars to read. And in my opinion, he's the third or fourth best player when healthy. We saw what he was finished top three in MVP voting the past two seasons that he's played. Last year was a weird anomaly as far as what he was doing, but there's every right that they can make the finals. And what do you want as a player? I mean, he's already a finals MVP. Living in LA, playing with LeBron or playing for the Clippers, yeah, that's cool and all, but to me at least, winning titles and consistent contendership, regardless of how I view the Lakers and what they have in store for their future, the Raptors have an easier path to the finals than the Lakers every year. As far as right now, NBA can change in a second. So that's my viewership of how I see that side. But then you look at DeMar's side. He's going to the Spurs to play for a top two, top three coach. That's being very modest too. He's probably the best coach in the NBA still. That molds his whole entire team around with the players he has. And they won 47 games, made the playoffs without Kawhi Leonard. And you add an all-star like DeMar's talent, and they could win 50 games. They could be one of the top four or five teams in that conference. Because there's, yes, it's the Warriors, but the Rockets lost a little bit of firepower. The Thunder ran it back. They made some smart moves, but who knows how that's going to look. I think it's going to be better than last year, obviously, but we'll see how that looks. The Timberwolves are in flux because Jimmy Butler, there's been reports he already denied. It's not a report. He already denied a contract extension to become an unrestricted free agent in 2019. But he's apparently fed up playing with Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins because they don't have the urgency. He wants to win now, and he's the leader, and he's playing with a bunch of young players. So the Timberwolves are in flux, going through the playoffs. The Trailblazers, they were the three seed. We'll see if they can duplicate that success, if they took advantage of some stretches. I'm a big Dame Lillard fan, but we'll see how that roster can handle that. The Lakers added LeBron, so they're going to be up there. The Jazz are only going to get better, but I mean, we've seen the Spurs do this year in and year out where everyone counts them out and they win 47 games. That was the first year in 20 years they haven't won 50 games. Yes, Tim Duncan's a big part of that. They lost Tony Parker, but you still have Ginobili, who's going to lead the bench. Lonnie Walker, the fourth, was a great draft pick for their spot. He's going to be on the bench. And you have a starting five of DeJounte Murray, DeMar DeRozan. We'll see what they do at the three with whether it's Rudy Gay or they go double guard with maybe they start Lonnie Walker. And then LaMarcus Aldridge and who's their center? I'm drawing blanks about their center right now. I don't know what the moves they did. But regardless, if DeMar wants to become a better basketball player, he's in the perfect spot because the one knock on him is his outside jump shot. And he's going to be working with the best shooting coach in the world in Chip English, who has changed a bunch. He fixed Kawhi's broken jumper that was not consistent or not mechanically sound in college. So, excuse me, him being in that organization is going to make him a better basketball player. Yes, the loyalty is going to that stings. You know, this NBA is not loyal anymore. It's a business. They've been trying. That's why these players are taking. They're signing 1 to 2 year deals a lot of the times because they want to be in full control of their brand. They want to be in full control of their mover, like where they want to be, where they want to play, who they want to play for. So it's tough to fault them. It's tough to fault the players that sign. Like Kevin Durant signed a 2 year deal, one year player option after the first year, so we can just keep signing $30 million contract or $30 million contract, and if he doesn't like what the Warriors are doing, he can get out of town. LeBron signed a 4 year deal with the player option on the fourth year, but that's because he's at the end of his road and he was sold on the long term picture of the Lakers. I don't know what the long term picture of the Spurs is outside of DeMar DeRozan being there, and he's going to be in a fan base that's going to appreciate him just as much as Toronto, playing for a better coach that's going to put him in places to succeed, and he gets to test himself. A lot of people say that he's not going to be an all-star ever again because he's going to be playing out west, and he's not going to get that free ride to the east. Well, here you go, DeMar. Here's the biggest challenge of your career, relocating to San Antonio and being handed the keys to this franchise, because that's what is really happening. LaMarcus Aldridge and him, they're going to mid-range people to death. A lot of people say the mid-range is going out of style. It's not the most effective way to play basketball, but here we have two second NBA all-team players that in LaMarcus Aldridge and DeMar DeRozan that are going to be playing side-by-side, and it's going to be a nice like old-school style of basketball, and it's going to see if it can work. But around them, there's going to be athletes that can defend, that will just feed them the ball and stuff like that. It's a test. There's no doubt about. There's no doubt it's going to be a test for DeMar DeRozan for this transition, and I'm excited for it. And we'll see. This will probably be the last NBA talk for the foreseeable future. We'll probably dive a lot in NFL. So we'll leave that at that. Great trade for both teams. It allows the Raptors to contend right away, and they can blow it up and start building for the future if the Kawhi experiment fails. And the Spurs got the best player they could possibly get in terms of win now, because Pop has like a couple years left, so they can win now with DeMar DeRozan. Because yes, they could have traded for some assets and stuff like that, but they want to win right now. So great trade for both. Leave it at that. The other big trade that happened yesterday was. Or 2 days ago, was Carmelo Anthony. He was rumored to get bought out. He was going to get bought out by the Thunder. So he was traded to the Hawks, part of a three-team deal. Justin Anderson with the Sixers. Justin Anderson went to Atlanta. Dennis Schroeder, a solid point guard, went to the Thunder from the Hawks. And Mike Musclair from the Hawks into the Sixers. So everyone got a little piece of deal. Carmelo's going to get bought out of his $27 million contracts. He's going to be a free agent, probably go to the Rockets. That's interesting. I mean, the Rockets need help. He wants to be on a contending team, so I guess they kind of find each other anyway. We'll see how that works out, because Mike D'Antoni literally resigned because he couldn't handle Melo. So we'll see how that goes if that deal actually comes to fruition. Thunder save $80 million in their luxury tax, which is good for that franchise because they obviously want to stay. They want to stay level because they have a lot of contracts on their books. And the Sixers get a stretch four to play next to Joel Embiid. They've had a quiet offseason. They've just been plucking away. They're going to count on Markelle Fultz to take a step forward. I think he will. They got that smart, savvy draft pick trading Mikal Bridges for Zaire Smith and the rights to the Miami Heat 2021 first-round draft pick. So that's just another quick, small, savvy move. Melo doesn't generate the hype after he's fallen apart the last couple seasons and stuff like that. His style of basketball doesn't really fit this stage of his career. So we'll leave basketball talk at that, and we're going to get into the interview with Noah. So, yeah, thanks for listening, guys. Here every Saturday. We'll get this is probably the end of basketball talk, probably strictly football, maybe some baseball talk with Manny Machado getting traded to the Dodgers. That was kind of the big news after All-Star weekend. So, yeah, enjoy this interview with Noah, and take it easy, guys. Hello, 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 and welcome to another edition of the Fern Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Duggar, and today's show got another football-centric show. We're going to talk a little college football, a little NFL, and to help me do so, of course, on the other line is Noah Hemer. Noah, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, Michael. Just happy to be back on the Fern Podcast talking some more football. I'm I've been talking with my coworkers. I'm just really excited for football season. It's about time that we're going to be getting some football back on our TV, you know?
Yeah, training camps, the first team in the NFL reported. The Baltimore Ravens reported on Wednesday. And teams will start filtering into their training camp locations as we progress towards the end of July. And speaking of the NFL, we're going to start there. We'll see where the conversation takes us, but one of the big stories in the NFL that happened this week is the franchise tags, and the biggest one is Le'Veon Bell, and him and the Steelers for the second straight season cannot come up to a deal. So he's got tagged for the second straight season. He's making $14 million with this season, but the big thing about it is he's looking for that 5-year, I think he's looking for $80 million contract with a lot of guaranteed money. And that's the thing with running backs in the NFL is they have a short shelf life and they just get recycled in and out because people don't view them as an essential part of the offense. And Le'Veon Bell's like, I have back-to-back years with over 400 touches. I'm the most productive running back year in, year out, can run routes, pass block. Probably the most appealing runner to watch in the eyes if you appreciate patience, cuts, just juking power. He's probably the best all around back in the NFL. And the contract that he was offered by the Steelers was in the 5-year, $70 million range. That would have topped that out about $16 million per year. Would have made him the highest paid running back in the NFL. But he declined. He views himself as more than that, and I don't blame him. Because we see receivers. Brandon Cooks just signed a 5-year, $80 million deal. And this is his third team in 3 years. And you wouldn't think he's as important to an offense as Le'Veon Bell is. So that's going to be the focal point of our NFL talk. And first off, do you think, before we get into the running back positions in a whole, do you think Le'Veon Bell, A, made the smart decision in turning down the 5-year, $70 million deals? And then B, given the cap structure of the modern NFL, do you think he's worth that extra $10
million? Yeah, I mean, when you watch the Steelers, dude, they're just... If Big Ben doesn't have anything deep, he checks down to Le'Veon, who's just chilling at the line of scrimmage, and he makes three dudes miss, and he gets 15 yards. It is his productivity when there's nothing there keeps that Pittsburgh drives alive, and it allows Big Ben to have an escape. And then Big Ben doesn't have to move as much because Le'Veon's such a safety net, as well as Antonio is such a safety net. So I don't know. Do you think Le'Veon's more important than Antonio to that offense? Because that's the question that the Steelers have to answer, you know?
Yeah, and the way that... Go ahead.
Because you can't pay both of them what Le'Veon and Antonio both want, you know? Because they're both going to be demanding very, very similar contracts. So you can't pay both of them and still be able to field a championship-winning team. So I think the Steelers did what they could and in the confines of the salary cap. And I really do think they tried to give him what he wanted. Mm-hmm. But I think he deserves more because he is such a weapon. You can line him up on the outside and he can play receiver. And he could arguably be the second or third best receiver with the emergence of Juju. Maybe not so much, but definitely the third best receiving option at a minimum on that team. So it's interesting to see where they're going to kind of go and deciding where it, because I don't know who do you pay? Because if you're not going to pay Le'Veon now, are you going to hold out and be like, all right, Le'Veon, we'll see you later. We're just going to go all in on AB and then get a new running back. But the thing is you lose such, your offense completely changes as soon as Le'Veon's out. And that's evident in the times where like 2 years ago when he had that knee injury. And as soon as he went out, the Steelers just kind of fell flat. Mm-hmm. So I'm not real sure exactly how, like, if you do, I'd pay him. I think he's worth it. I'd rather have him on my team than I can't decide if I'd rather have him or Levy or hit, yeah, if I'd rather have him or Antonio. But that's the question that the Steelers front office has to answer, is if we can't get it Le'Veon for what this is it worth to pay him that much and then potentially lose all of the surrounding pieces?
Yeah, I'm looking at the Antonio Brown contract situation right now, and it's kind of crazy because his base salary for this season is $915,000.
Highway and robbery.
Yeah, and then next year, his four-year, $68 million contract kicks in. And you started touching on a little bit. How do you see, the way I look at it is, Le'Veon makes, it's, do you think Juju Smith and James Washington, who they drafted, are more, can that pair replace an Antonio Brown more so than James Conner replacing Le'Veon's production in the short-term future? Because AB's 30, this is his age 30 season, and he's such a clinical route runner and the best. He's the best receiver in football, no bar none. But that's a wide receiver factory that they just produce in year in, year out. They just shipped Martavis Bryant out, and you know, we like you said in that playoff game against the Patriots, Le'Veon went out. And the whole, it was over. Nothing they can do anything, because smart teams are going to double. They're going to double Antonio Brown. If you can't, like, it's tough because they're such a great pair, and they make each other better. So, I would pay him, and then I'd figure out, because the cap's going to keep going up. You know, we talk about how there's cap savvy teams, but teams like the Jaguars, they don't stop spending. They see a weakness, they go and splash out the cash, and they continue doing that. And they're building a monster team, and they're going to have room. They're going to navigate their cap situation to re-sign a Jalen Ramsey in a year. They signed Telvin Smith. You can just, if you can draft smart, you'll be fine. And the Pittsburgh offense gets a lot of offensive line. They're talented, but Le'Veon makes that offensive line look a lot better than they do. So, I mean, 5 years, $7 million, that's a fair deal for most running backs, but we're talking about Le'Veon Bell, who week in, week out, when healthy, and he's been healthy for most of his career, is the best back in football. And, you know, I can't say no for someone in football, especially trying to get as much money as they possible, as possibly they can, especially an NFL running back.
I have made a firm stance that I used to kind of always try to root for the team to try to maximize their cap and kind of finesse the salaries back and forth. But honestly, after all the things that have started to come out with the NFL and just how awful they treat their players, I'm all on the boat for players making as much money as they can. I mean, like, Darrelle Revis just retired, and he made, I think I saw a graphic where he made like 40 more million than the next corner beneath him. And it's just like, because he just kept testing free agency. Sue's in the same boat. He just kept testing free agency. So I wouldn't be surprised if Le'Veon's probably just thinking to himself, like, dude, if I test free agency next year, I'm going to be making so much more than this. Like, look at what Kirk Cousins got this offseason from the Vikings. I know he's a quarterback, but, like, he got ridiculous cash thrown at him. I can only imagine the type of cash that some teams would throw at Le'Veon to because he completely changes an offense regardless of how good or bad your offensive line is. That's the crazy thing about Le'Veon, is that no matter how good, how bad you're, like, if the Bucks, for example, would have gotten Le'Veon Bell, that entire offense transforms much more than them just getting Ronald Jones. Not that I'm saying the Bucks would ever get Le'Veon Bell, because we don't, even if he did come, he'd probably suck, because we don't get good things to happen to us. So, I don't know. I'd pay Le'Veon, but it's tough, because when you just look at the statistics of how running backs are, I mean, like, Arian Foster was a stud in Houston, and then as soon as he started getting older, injuries started derailing him. I think he tore his Achilles, and then that kind of never really bounced back after that. So it's like you're taking a big risk by trying to pay Le'Veon for those 4 or 5 years, and he's getting all that guaranteed money. But running backs do get hurt more so than any other position because like you said, he had 400 touches last year. How sustainable is it, regardless of talent? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm applauding him for putting his feet down, trying to get as much money over the long term contract as possible. And I don't know all the facts and stipulations about the contract, but he should get a front loaded contract that's like $40 million guaranteed, $50 million guaranteed, and stuff like that. And I'm looking at the NFL depth charts right now, and the only teams that really stand out to me that would have the cap space and the need at running back are the Houston Texans, if they cut with Lamar Miller, which they can, and then a team that I think I'd have no problem seeing them do it is the Oakland Raiders. And they have Marshawn Lynch for another year. They have Doug Martin. And I could just see them throwing out the cash for a Le'Veon Bell. And I just want him to get paid, wherever that is. He's the most entertaining running back to watch on football. And that leads us to our next question. So, outside of Le'Veon Bell, for a growing trend, well, it's kind of been debunked lately because we've had running backs go in the top 10 consistently for the past 3 or 4 drafts, is that the position as a whole is devalued. And I'm looking at the contracts of the top running backs in the NFL. You have Devontae Freeman. He's in the midst of a 5-year, $41 million contract. LeSean McCoy, 5-year, $40 million. Jerick McKinnon just signed a 4-year, $30 million contract. But he has a $12 million buyout option after just this season. So if he gets hurt, underperforms, 49ers can just use that excess cap space and toss him aside. And then you're looking down, you have Fournette, Ezekiel Elliott, McCaffrey, and Saquon. They all have the first round top 10, top 5 rookie contracts, which are really expensive. And the list goes so on. Deion Lewis, Mark Ingram, Duke Johnson, Giovanni Bernard, Carlos Hyde, Latavius Murray, and then Le'Veon Bell. And then Todd Gurley, who's due for an extension after the 2019 season, and they're going to want to get that done. So, and I'm going to go all the way down to the list, and they're still productive running backs. You know, Kareem Hunt, second or third round pick. Same with Dalvin, Alvin Kamara. There's all these running backs that you can get in the second round that are productive, and they don't cost as much towards your caps. David Johnson, he's still owed. He signed a 4-year, $2.9 million contract as a rookie. He's due for a big extension. So we're seeing a running back kind of resurgence. And take Le'Veon out of the question. With the modern offenses, you watch a lot of college football, and we're seeing the spread option and do-it-all running back come back to the NFL. So in the modern NFL, do you think that the resurgence is real and that these running backs are going to, as a whole, start putting their foot down and taking a chunk out of these NFL contracts and saying, we demand this, we're not irreplaceable as you guys might think?
Well, a big part of it plays off of what happens in the 2020 CBA, because the last one that they signed, I was 2010 probably, I think they're 10-year contracts. The owners absolutely demolished the players union. They didn't have a chance, because I read an article, I think SB Nation put it out, that the players association didn't prep their players to be, they didn't save the money, so they couldn't hold out to try to get better, to get a better deal, because these guys were broke. Like I read that Vince Young took out a massive loan to just keep his lifestyle afloat. So but going back to the whole college football thing, you're seeing a lot of offenses transform, particularly like if you watched I watched a lot of UCF and Scott Frost last year for obvious reasons, and all of his skill players can do both. They can run the ball with ball. They're the best when the ball's in their hand, but they can also motion out and be a receiver, have the versatility that they need to be able to run routes. If you have a one-on-one opportunity with against a linebacker or against maybe a slower safety and you're a little shiftier guy, I honestly think the NFL is going to slowly but surely progress farther away from NFL running backs like a Leonard Fournette, like a Adrian Peterson, a Mark Ingram. Honestly, even a like Zeke's great, not necessarily in the pass game, but I can't necessarily. Zeke's done some great things in the pass game. But if you can pass block, you're going to find yourself on a roster. But I think being able to catch the ball out of the backfield and being able to have the versatility like Le'Veon is going to be much more essential moving forward. So I think the resurgence of the running back is about to be huge, just because I think the development of offenses, I think you're going to be seeing a lot more RPO action, especially like look at what the Eagles did when they ran RPO and they had someone that could actually run it effectively. You know, they got whatever matchup they wanted. But imagine like the Eagles didn't have a great core of running backs. Like they have the trade for Jay Ajayi, who's, he's good, but he's not going to blow you away. He didn't transform that running game like people were hoping he would.
But I think they had Blunt, Corey Clement, who I really like. They have a lot of, and now Darren Sproles is back, but he's not kind of really going to be a factor. That's what the reports at NFL camp are saying. So to build off what you were saying, is that something I noticed when you were saying all these running backs is that outside of Le'Veon and David Johnson and Todd Gurley, and yeah, those are probably the three best running backs in football, everyone's under 6 feet. Everyone can just make plays in open field. It's all about the explosive play. And, you know, these three down plotters aren't going to get it. Adrian Peterson, he had a couple 100-yard games last year for Arizona, but that's because Arizona had no quarterback. All the running backs got injured. And then they would just force feed him. And there's no, it's all about catching your opponent off target, keeping him off balance. And if you're going to throw an Adrian Peterson in the backfield or a Latavius Murray, even I'm looking at this. I feel like Mark Ingram he's a better pass catcher. Maybe just off screenplays, but same with Zeke. I feel like they're just really good off of screenplays and getting their, they also run behind the two best O-lines in football. So them, I'm going down the list, like Chris Thompson. I love Chris Thompson. Redskins love Chris Thompson. Very effective. Who did keep going? Who's the running back that Corey Grant, the Jacksonville Jaguars running back?
Oh, yeah, that short, little, speedy, quick guy. Yeah, dude, yeah, that number guy 30. Has wheels.
Yeah, when he was in the game against the Patriots, they were exponentially better and more dangerous. Fournette's in the game. He can pass block a little bit, but he doesn't offer that out of the backfield. So I don't even think Fournette is going to get the next big contract. And it's just like Joe Mixon. I wrote about him in an article. He trimmed down 15, 20 pounds because his power, he needs speed. He needs to be able to make plays in the open field. Like, I don't know about you, but we're both Deion Lewis fans. Do you think Derrick Henry is really going to take any touches away from Deion Lewis except on the goal line or to close out games when the defenses are tired?
No, Deion's going to be a stud this year. All I'm saying is that they can get the right offense around Marcus Mariota and they can actually use him in the shotgun where he belongs and run some option and let him use his wheels. Dude, Deion Lewis is the perfect running back to be right next to Marcus Mariota in a spread option like that.
Yeah, and I saw a statistic. That word's tough to say when you're trying to mumble. That Matt LaFleur, who's now the offensive coordinator of the Titans, for the last three seasons of offenses he's been a part of, running backs have over 100 targets. And I'm going to look to the top five offenses. The Saints use both running backs in pass game. The Patriots, same thing. James White, your boy, Sexy Rexy. Burkhead, that is. Steelers, Le'Veon Bell. Falcons, Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman, they both get plenty of pass-catching opportunities. Chargers, Melvin Gordon has improved as a pass-catching running back this last season, and he's been working with Adanian Tomlinson on improving that. And then you have Austin Eckler, who's a dynamic running back. And then keep going, the Packers don't really. The Eagles do. Corey Clement had a catching touchdown in the Super Bowl. Todd Gurley had 85 catches last season. Dalvin Cook, before he got hurt, same thing. Then the Lions, who used Theo Riddick literally as a pass-catching running back. So, to build on your point, if the running back's not getting devalued, it's just getting transformed into if you can't catch and if you can't pass block and if you don't have some semblance of explosion, then you're just not going to last and you're not going to get that money. Like we just saw Jerick McKinnon get, and he's smaller, but he's put on weight to withstand the more hits he's going to get. And he's due for a breakout year. So it's just weird to watch this, you know. I wasn't the biggest McCaffrey fan. He was kind of underutilized last year. I wouldn't have drafted Fournette. You're big on Saquon Barkley. I'm not real. I mean, with what the Giants needed, I wouldn't draft a running back that high.
The things Saquon can do. Go ahead.
No. I was waiting for you.
Oh, I'm just saying. The things that Saquon can do when he has a ball in his hands is just absurd. He just made so many guys look ridiculous last year. And the only knock I have on Saquon, and it's something that Ronald Jones does just so much better, is Ronald Jones has such great vision and never gets touched because he uses his blocks so well. And that's something Saquon, who has all the physical capability in the world, he needs to learn to follow the read and read the blocks. But getting him one-on-one in the open field, you're not tackling him. It's just not going to happen. You got to be Brian Urlacher or something. I don't know. You got to be a Hall of Fame type guy to be able to bring down Saquon Barkley in the open field.
Well, we'll see. He has to get to the open field first. And I know
that's
Giants improved their O-line
that's
a little
the whole
bit.
Issue.
Yeah, I know, and I see I know he's a workout warrior, and if the NFL and ESPN and SportsCenter and all these social media feeds never stop showing him shirtless doing box jumps and deadlifts, and it's kind of rubbing me the wrong way because they're trying to like force feed this new superstar, quote unquote, down our throats. But you know, it's just. There's just a lot of ways that could have went with that. And I feel like, you know, the Patriots have a running back by committee. And they have. Here's what it is. Here's my final thing I'm going to say. Then I'll send it to you to close it out. The Patriots are a good example. The Eagles are a good example. They have three different kind of running backs. So if you're going to pay for the jack of all trades back, like a Jerick McKinnon, Dalvin, Le'Veon, David Johnson, Kareem Hunt, Alvin Kamara, all these top-end running backs that can do it all in the mix, that's fine. The other approach is to do a running back by committee and get the bruising power running back like the Eagles had last year with LeGarrette Blount or the Patriots had last year. They tried to with Mike Gillislee, and they settled on Rex Burkhead. Then they have their 20-20 open field players, Deion Lewis, Jay Jai, Corey Clement, and then you have the pass catching running backs like a James White in this. But the thing about that is they can all simply just take a handoff. But having them in the backfield in a shotgun allows the offense to, you know, they could do the little simple handoff. They could easily make linebackers mix in open field. So there's only, I mean, it sounds obvious, but you either have to have a running back by committee where you have multiple looks, or you have one guy that can do it at all.
But even that, you don't ever see a whole lot of one running back lead a team to the Super Bowl. Like, it just doesn't happen. Because those guys, mm-hmm. you can't play 19 games as a running back and not get banged up and try to lead your team through the playoffs. It's just not going to happen. But I think it's interesting because if you're not a LeGarrette Blount type and you're not a big power bruising guy, I don't really see a... If you're not on the same level as LeGarrette Blount or at least striving to be, and you're a big running back like a Derrick Henry, like a Leonard Fournette, who in college just overpowered the college players, you can't do that in the NFL. So it's interesting to kind of look at and see where those guys are going to fall over the next couple of years, because I don't really think they're going to have a place in the NFL. Like, they will maybe in goal line situations, but Rex Burkhead's not a big dude by any means, and he took all the goal line touches for the Patriots last year. So unless you can ball like LeGarrette Blount and you're a big dude that just seems to always get yards, almost like a Jerome Bettis, like, you gotta be that big, that powerful to be able to keep a job in the NFL as a running back, because I don't think Leonard's going to be sustainable. He's not explosive enough. He doesn't make you miss left or right. He doesn't make enough plays when a play isn't there for me to warrant a top 10 pick. Like, the Giants should not have taken Saquon because they just have so many other needs. Oh, but what I was going to say, circling back to the Patriots, don't forget that Bill Belichick spent a first-round pick on Sony Michel, the running back out of Georgia. But look at the type of running back he is. It was him or Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb was the more bruisier guy, wasn't all that flashy. And if you watch Sony Michel, dude, that guy was a lightning bolt coming out of a can, dude. He was just so explosive. And as soon as he got in the open field, especially in that playoff game in the Rose Bowl against Georgia, dude, as soon as he hit the sideline, no one was catching him. Or against Oklahoma, excuse me, he played for Georgia. As soon as he hits the sidelines, no one's catching that guy. He is so explosive. And he only ran like a 4.5, he didn't run a great 40, but his splits, his 10 and 20 yard splits were just through the roof. And so he got slept on, I think. And Bill Belichick hopped on it, but look at the type of running back that Bill Belichick's going at. He's not going after a Leonard Fournette. He's not going after a Zeke. He's going after a guy that is super explosive, has the possibility to just pop off anytime he gets the ball in his hands. And they're not going to ask him to carry it every single down and try to get them 3 yards. They're going to use him in so many different ways. Like, it's going to be so interesting to see how the Patriots use Sony Michel, because he is such a weapon, and they're the one team that know exactly how to utilize someone with his talent.
Yeah, so I like Michelle. This was a deep running back of the class, so that's why I felt like the Giants in particular could have drafted a Quentin Nelson and Bradley Chubb, just one of these players to make a difference outside of offense, and they could have drafted a Darius Geis, another player in the second round. So we'll leave the NFL running back discussion at that, and we'll transition to college. And you texted me asking me what I thought the toughest conference in college football was, but I'm going to let you do the quick little background story of what prompted this conversation, and then I'll let you defend your first who ranks at the top of this list for you.
So the Big 12 and the media days are happening for all the conferences. The ACC is going on this weekend. Big 12 is going on. SEC was earlier this week. Big 10's later next week, I think, or later this weekend. But the Big 12 had a slogan saying, hardest path to the CFP, hardest path to the college football playoff. And I saw that and I was just like, y'all don't play defense in the Big 12. How do you have the hardest path? No one's standing in your way. Y'all just run to the end zone and watch each other score. I mean, if you watch a Baylor, Texas Tech, if you watch any Texas Tech game, there's no defense, but there's a lot of offense. So I don't know how the Big 12 could ever claim that they're the toughest road, other than they don't have a conference championship game, so you don't always have a clear-cut, defined winner. But that's more their fault than anyone else's. Like, you could easily expand if you wanted to and get back up to 12, even though the Big 12's at 10 and the Big 12, or the Big 10 was once at 12, which is ironic. But there's no way it's the Big 12. If I had to go toughest
division or conference, yeah.
Toughest division.
We could do both. We could start overall conference, and then we can go division if you want.
They got snubbed out of it last year, but... Oh, wow. I'd say the Big Ten East is probably the toughest division in college football. And I say that because you have Ohio State, Michigan State, Penn State, Michigan, all as the top four. That is such a top heavy. Because when you look at the West has Wisconsin. They're solid. They're always going to be solid. But after that, Northwestern's always a wild card. Iowa continually disappoints. Purdue is a floor-level Big Ten team that's on the rise. Nebraska now has Scott Frost, but for the past 10 years have been nothing to have lust over. Minnesota and PJ Fleck, it's not all that impressive. And then you have Lovie Smith at Illinois, and that is... That might be on the same level as Herm Edwards at Arizona State, but that's
Don't insult Herm. Don't insult Herm.
I'm excited.
I like that hire.
I'm excited to see how that hire goes. I have no idea how that hire is going to go, but I don't know how you don't. The only other division that rivals the Big Ten East is the SEC West, where you have Auburn, Alabama, LSU. But outside of that, the SEC East isn't all that. I mean, Florida sucked over the past since Urban left. South Carolina has been lackluster. Missouri's bad. Tennessee's been awful ever since Peyton Manning's been out of there. But on the other end, you have SEC West. Mississippi State's usually pretty solid. LSU's always has immense talent. Alabama is Alabama, and then you got Auburn, who's right up there with Alabama every single year. So you have a pretty top heavy swinging four.